two friends taking pictures of the rising full moon on a summer night.
Two teenage kids doing what teenage kids do.
When a stranger with a gun and a death wish changed everything.
It was violent, it was senseless, and I will never understand it, I will never accept it.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and unfortunately, we're all too familiar with stories about how violence shatters lives. But what we rarely see is how they are rebuilt. In a new podcast, The Letter, we relive tragedy, but only so we can hear the rest of the story. The struggle to reclaim lives, the realities of grief, and the possibilities of forgiveness.
I believe in miracles. Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Inside Sources. Inside Sources with Boyd Matheson.
Well, scientists from the National Institutes of Health are getting royalty payments from pharmaceutical companies and other private companies. It's a practice that's happened for decades. No accusations of any wrongdoing other than, are we doing this the wrong way? Now there's a new push to open the books so we can see who's getting paid for what and where those conflicts of interest might be. Really pleased to have joining us on the program today, Adam Andrzejewski, who is the CEO and founder of OpenTheBooks.com, a nonprofit that investigates government spending at every level. We are a group that believes in transparency, and shining light is the best disinfectant. And Adam, thanks for joining us today.
Well, it's great to be on the program, Boyd. Thank you very much for having me on.
Well, wonderful. Let's dive into this because this is one of those areas where, again, as long as we've got transparency, we can work it through. But kind of give us how this came to your attention and what is it actually that you're looking at?
Well, we had noticed that all the way back in 2005, so 17 years ago, that's the last time there was transparency on the National Institutes of Health, NIH, on their royalty database. Here's what it is. It is payments from third parties, think pharmaceutical companies, back into the agency at NIH and at 1,700 scientists. And so the payments enrich the agency and its scientists. Every single one of those payments could be a conflict of interest. So we filed a Freedom of Information Act request for the database. This was 8 months ago. NIH refused to even acknowledge it. They never responded. So we sued them with Judicial Watch in federal court. And the case moved quickly. We won, and on judicially mandated production, NIH admitted to holding 3,000 pages. Nobody knew the size and scope of this practice. Turns out, we're able to estimate now, it's $350 million that flowed back into the agency from, think, Big Pharma over the course of the last 10 years. And its leaders were getting the royalties as well, which calls into question the whole program of giving royalties. Because, Boyd, as you know, every year NIH doles out $32 billion in grants. That's taxpayer money to the entire industry. Now we know that every 10 years, hundreds of millions of dollars is flowing back the other way, enriching the scientists, its leadership, and NIH itself.
So many thoughts. So as we look at this, and again, I think for the average listener, for most of us sitting here, that just doesn't sound right. That doesn't smell right. That doesn't taste right, probably because it's not right. So how do we get to that kind of transparency where we can at least know, okay, this pharmaceutical company is giving royalties back to this person who works at the National Institute of Health. They maybe have a little bit of an incentive to, you know, push that particular procedure or that particular remedy for something. How do we actually get to that point?
So the only way to get to that point, Boyd, it's an excellent question, is quite simply to be able to follow the money. So I can tell you on top line numbers that $350 million over 10 years was the gross amount of the royalty payments. But here's the thing. And I can also tell you that there's 1,700 scientists' names in the database. But what I can't tell you is how much each individual scientist, including Fauci and the former head of NIH, Francis Collins, received. I can count the number of royalty payments, but they blacked out, they redacted the amount of the payment. And furthermore, they blacked out and redacted the third-party payer. So if it's a pharmaceutical company, I cannot tell you the name. We don't know who paid $350 million worth of royalty payments.
Wow. All right. Now, we know that this was the subject of a congressional hearing this month. Did we learn anything from this, or was this more not a hearing, more just a speaking from members of Congress sitting on the dais?
Well, so 36 hours after our report launched at OpenTheBooks.com, it led to 5 minutes with the acting director, Lawrence Tabak, in the hot seat, 5 minutes of questioning about these royalty payments. And finally, at minute four, he confessed that every single one of those payments could have the appearance of a conflict of interest. Exactly what we're saying. So we've called on the National Institutes of Health to open the books, to show us exactly who's paying how much to each of the scientists. It is the only fair way to debate this issue.
Yeah, absolutely. So what are the next steps? What happens next in terms of actually getting the books open so we can actually see what's going on, how the money's flowing? As you said, following the money usually gets us to the right space in terms of what is actually going on in terms of influence peddling or the wealthy and the well-connected getting more wealthy and more well-connected through these kinds of processes.
Exactly. So we're going back into court. Our lawyers are Judicial Watch, and we're going back in to unredact all the redactions. And that should be a knockdown, drag-out fight, because NIH is certainly acting like they have a lot to hide. In the congressional hearing, the acting director, that Lawrence Tabak, he said that there's nothing to be concerned about because we have firewalls. I mean, I'm not buying it. $350 million over 10 years enriching the agency who has a vested interest in keeping hundreds of millions of dollars flowing. And they dole out $32 billion a year in grants. I want to see who's paying the royalties. We already have captured who's getting the grants. I want to put the two databases together.
That's right. Yeah, that is the ultimate. And if we can connect those dots, the magic of transparency will take place.
And we can do it. Our auditors at OpenTheBooks.com, we are forensic auditors. We are data scientists. Let me tell you, even to get the top line numbers off of these horribly redacted production from the National Institutes of Health took our data scientists. If we didn't employ data scientists, I wouldn't even have this story for you here today, Boyd.
Wow. Wow. That is just stunning. And again, this is one of those we started the show today talking about trust in institutions of government. And this is one of those things that just undermines trust where there just seems to be this kind of collusion. And again, we don't know who did what. Many of those should be, could be absolutely straight up right on. But we have to know. And in the absence of that, trust continues to erode.
Do you have time for an example?
Please.
Great. So back in 2005, as I mentioned, the Associated Press got the whole unredacted database so they could follow the money. And right off the top, they exposed a scandal. And it was Dr. Anthony Fauci in 2005. They discovered he received $45,000 worth of royalty payments for an experimental AIDS drug, a drug that was funded with $36 million of U.S. taxpayer money. Fauci's the head of an institute at NIH, obviously very powerful, can direct funding. His name's on the patent. He's receiving royalties as the U.S. taxpayer funded this thing for $36 million. And even after he was receiving royalties, taxpayer money continued to flow to continue to enhance the drug. So Fauci upfront admitted that it was a conflict of interest, and he said he would donate. Trust me, I'll donate the payments, the royalty payments, to charity. That was the answer.
Wow. That is stunning. And so where do we go from here? What should we be watching for in the coming months?
So we were able to forecast $350 million over a 10-year period because NIH has produced only 1,200 pages out of the 3,000 pages. We're getting 300 a month. And on that basis, we're able to forecast the largesse. Every single month, we get new production, 300 new pages, and we're going to be able to expose a new investigation on that production every month. So stay tuned. These things, we've put together some of these preliminary numbers on what we can figure out. It is absolutely stunning what's going on in this program. And it's all funded by your tax dollars at NIH. It's a federal agency. They're running this program. It's absolutely stunning.
Wow. Adam Andrzejewski is the CEO and founder of OpenTheBooks.com. This is an important conversation in transparency and what happens in this. Adam, we'll have you back as this continues to emerge. But thanks for joining us today and giving us the update.
Thank you, Boyd.
All right. That is a head scratcher for me. That is one of those things that undermines trust. If you have someone who is over an agency directing billions of dollars in research to pharmaceutical companies and then is getting royalties back on those same drugs and medications, that's a trust problem. We got to get it right. All right. We'll step aside for top of the hour news. Much more to come. Hour number two of Inside Sources coming up on KSL News Radio.
Inside Sources. Where KSL offers Utah deeper insights on the news. Host Boyd Matheson divides rage from reason and elevates the conversation on issues crucial to our community. On KSL News Radio 102.7 FM and 1160 AM.
Well, the headlines continue to suggest that you soon might be feeling a little more of a squeeze in your pocketbook, even more than we do now. A lot of talking heads say that the United States may be headed for a recession or even the stagflation. So what is that behind the headline? And what does it really mean for you and for the economy? Let's begin.
Think you know the news of the day? Think again.
Of course, there's a lot of conversations going on in terms of the state of the economy and what is going on. And we're really thrilled to have joining us for the first time on the program, Dr. Thomas Hoenig, Distinguished Senior Fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. And of course, before that, he was the President and Chief Executive Officer of the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City. Dr. Hoenig, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm glad to be with you today.
So as we look at where the U.S. economy is, give us a sense of where we are, and then let's project forward into inflation, stagflation, and help us separate that out.
Well, where we are right now is we're at a very early stage of trying to address an inflationary problem that has built up over the past year. So we had a very strong economy coming into 2022. It actually remained fairly strong in the first quarter, although GDP was stagnant. Consumer demand was very strong, and the reason that our GDP was negative was we imported an awful lot of goods compared to what we exported. So that actually just reduced the numbers. So on balance, the economy was strong. However, inflation was 8.5%. It remains at 8.3%. And so the inflationary factors in the economy began to actually reduce our public's real income. Inflation is 8%. Wage increases are 5.5%. So you have a real reduction in real income. And as we go forward from here, as the Fed has announced, it's going to fight inflation now, first and foremost. That means interest rates will be rising. It also will be shrinking its balance sheet. And this will very much slow the economy going forward. And the most important part of that is the Federal Reserve is just getting started at that. They've raised interest rates by 75 basis points. They've just started reducing their balance sheet and from $9 trillion to $45 billion, less than $9 trillion. So they're only getting started in reducing their balance sheet. So we have a lot of further tightening ahead of us, and that will slow the economy even more.
Yeah. And so as you look at all of that, I want to hit kind of both sides of the equation. And the president said today from Japan that a recession was not inevitable. And so let's talk about maybe some of the things that are going right in the economy. What are the things that are going right that give you some confidence in terms of how we will weather this storm?
Well, the things that are going right at the moment is that people have not stopped spending. They haven't become so afraid that they are unwilling to spend. Consumer demand remains reasonably strong. While some investment has slowed, investment is still taking place. So what we have right now is a slowing economy, but not a collapsing economy, and that's a very positive thing in this environment. So if we can continue to slow the economy and bring inflation down without a recession, that would be the best of all outcomes. But as I said at the beginning, we're only starting the tightening cycle, so we have a lot more to face in the next several months that will determine whether or not we have a recession or not. And I think there's still a very high risk of a recession.
Yeah. And so as you look at the headwinds on that, what are the things that do you mentioned that we're just at the beginning of this process? I think that's really important for us to keep in perspective. What are some of the other things on the horizon that are worrisome to you in terms of how we navigate this?
Well, think about it for a moment. If they continue to raise rates, as they say they're going to, towards a rate of, say, let's say 2% to 2.5% by the end of July. If you think about that for a moment, on interest rates, that's about a 8- to 10-fold increase in interest rates. That's a significant increase if they follow through on that in interest rates. So that's going to slow the economy. Your hope is that it slows the economy and doesn't stop the economy. On the other side of that, they're allowing the balance sheet to run off from at a rate of about, starting in June, about $95 billion a month. That is a very significant reduction in liquidity in the market for the economy, and that would further slow the economy. And if those things were to catch at once and people begin to see the effects of that as too much, then they would stop spending and we could very quickly take a dive into a recession. So the hope is that this pace, even though it is significant, is not so fast that it causes the consumer, businesses, small businesses, large businesses alike to lose confidence and therefore begin to stop their spending altogether. Yeah. That's the biggest risk.
Yeah.
Is we have a dramatic slowdown in the economy all at once.
And are there other things that the Fed ought to be looking at from a policy standpoint? Everyone always talks about that soft landing. Is a soft landing even possible, or are we just going to have a little bit of bounce?
Well, a soft landing would be a very unusual event. It would be very good, but very unusual. Most times when you have inflation that's been increasing at this rate, whether it's partially due to supply disruptions, it's also very much due to very strong demand incentives in the economy. If you have 8% inflation as a result of that, to get it back down towards 2% usually involves either a mild recession or more than a mild recession. But very seldom does it allow you to avoid recession altogether. Possible, you never want to rule it out, but difficult and generally unlikely.
And what is the thing that we're not thinking about or that we're not talking about when it comes to the economy that we should be watching for in the months ahead?
Well, the best thing is if you could get your supply disruptions addressed, that would help on one side of it. But it's a little bit late in terms of the demand side, given the amount of money that has been put into the economy. So what we have to watch is the pace at which we raise interest rates and the pace with which we withdraw the stimulus that has been put in place on the Fed's balance sheet. What you would hope for is that once you get to 2.25%, you can pause long enough to let the lag effects of this tightening catch up and therefore allow for a smoother slowing in the future months. That is the, say, October, November, December of this year, so that you can avoid a serious recession. That's got to be the focus of the Fed and of the government as it plans for its next budget, is how do I do this in a way that doesn't trigger a dramatic slowdown in the economy? That is the challenge they face. They have not had experience with this in recent times, so it's going to be a new experience for us all. And how well they manage that will be what we're all going to be watching and looking for in the future. Now, the other part of this is if things start to slow and they reverse themselves too quickly, they will reignite inflation. So they have to avoid that at the same time.
Yeah.
So it is a very razor-thin knife that they're trying to walk at the moment.
Yeah, and then finally, I just want to ask you real quickly, just in terms of you mentioned that budget and government spending moving forward. Obviously, that has an impact on the inflation and where we are now. What should lawmakers be looking at as they, especially as they get to the end of the fiscal year and are doing those projections in September? What's the real key things we should be watching in that space when it comes to government spending and how that will impact both inflation and the economy?
Well, government spending, like monetary policy itself, has to moderate. You know, when you went from pre-pandemic in 2019 to 2020, they increased the spending about 50%, and then they did it again in 2021. Mm-hmm. Now we're in 2022, and it'll be a little bit lower. But how they decide on how much to spend, given the entitlements that have to be funded, given the fact that we're providing support to the Ukraine, we have to support our own future needs that are not necessarily entitlements alone, highway infrastructure. How they decide to spend that money will influence how much spending goes forward and influence the inflationary pressures that the economy faces in the next year to year and a half. And so you have that they have to be, the government has to be very careful about. And then you have monetary policy that they also have to be very careful about. And they have to make sure they mesh together so that they don't exactly accelerate the downside, nor do they accelerate the inflationary pressures. That is one huge challenge for both the government and the Federal Reserve to coordinate in a way that manages the economy and allows for a softer landing than they would otherwise have if they don't coordinate those actions.
Living on a razor's edge, to be short. Dr. Thomas Haenig, distinguished senior fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, and of course he was the president and chief executive officer of the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City. Dr. Haenig, thank you so much for joining us today. Great insight.
And glad to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Really important stuff there from a former Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City chief executive officer, and so many things to think about in terms of how we navigate this. It is tricky. There are some good things. There's some positive things in terms of the economy, and there's a lot to be worried about and concerned about how Congress navigates it, how monetary policy navigates all of that is going to determine what we're all living with. And how we're able to stretch things out in our own personal bank accounts, as well as what we do as a country.
I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast, Cold. In October of 1985, a woman named Cherie Warren left work at a busy Salt Lake City office
to meet her estranged husband at a downtown auto dealership.
She never made it home. Cherie's car surfaced weeks later in Las Vegas.
In the parking lot of a hotel casino.
No one knows how it got there.
Strange. It was strange.
Both Cherie's estranged husband and her boyfriend raised suspicion for investigators.
I kind of thought that he might have done something.
But no arrests were ever made. In Cold Season 3, we dig into double lives, make new connections in the case, and examine the difficulty raised by reasonable doubt.
We want answers just as much as anyone else.
They have creeps like that now, too, so nothing's changed.
That's the new Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie. Now available anywhere you get your podcasts.